books. I mean, it's in your pack. So could you put minutes before we go to the briefing? It's a very short minute. We need six people for a quorum. Six. We're five, so we can look at it, and when the sixth individual walks in, we can formally adopt it. Is that okay? Because we can't adopt it until we're six. So can we do that? So with that change then, opening, apologies, minutes, briefing by AG, discussion and closure, are there any other agenda items people, honourable members want to add or remove? Happiness? Thank you very much. AG and your team, welcome. And also just to indicate to members that normal practice, honourable members, is that the AG, and it has happened all along, the AG has always given us documents in good time. There was a hitch this time, and I agreed with the Department of Honours Department, but the AG and his office that it could come a bit late. So if it has disadvantaged members, let me apologise. But it's not as if that's the normal practice from the AG's office. The documents did come and were distributed, which the AG will talk to, and we then can have a discussion on it. And that is really a follow-up on our own discussions last year around the possible strengthening of the Public Finance Management Act. Also, secondly, to indicate to members that originally we had put on the agenda the strat plan, but we had asked the team to go and do more work on the strat plan. We wouldn't do justice on the strat plan if we tried to combine it with today's meeting. They're doing more work on it, and at an appropriate time, we will do the strat plan. Correct? So we're busy working on the document. We will come back to you in terms of a proposal of the strat plan meeting for you to comment on before we start the actual planning for it. So it's work in progress, honourable members, and I would assume that in the next 2 weeks we'll give you a draft proposal on the strat plan. And that is why the original notification spoke about strat plan, but it's not on this agenda item. I hope it's understood by members that the strat plan will be put on hold until we've done more work on it. Can we, AG and your team, as we said, you're welcome. Thank you very much. You'll just bear with us for 5 minutes while you do the minutes, and then we'll come back to you, if that's okay. And honourable members, if we then went to the minutes dated the 29th of November, that were here in 337. And that is in your pack. Oh, before we do that, in terms of apologies, honourable members, we received only one apology from Ms. Bengu. Oh, and from the DA, Mr. Totten, he did indicate that he's in finance today.
Yes.
Correct, yes. He's in finance today, and Ms. Bengu, so those are the two apologies that we've received. Are there any other apologies?
Thank you, Chair, and apologize for arriving late. Oh, I'm trapped in a traffic. Can I be released at half past 7? I should be in Polokwane around 4. There's something that I have to attend to. Thanks.
I'm sure that applies to Mr. Singh and everybody else that goes to KZN and so on. So we're going to try and be done by around about that time, sir. Thanks, Honourable Asangwan. We'll try and be done by then and make time for the threat plan and give you sufficient time in terms of how long it's going to take. But for today, we're hoping to be done by 12 o'clock, certainly half past 11, 12 o'clock at the latest. Minutes of the 29th of November on page 1, are there any changes? Oh, sorry, Mr. Singh, I beg your pardon.
No, Chair, we can do the minutes, and then I just want to ask something.
Or may I ask now? Yeah, I just want to know, Chair, it may be out of order, that since the Auditor General is here with his senior team, and there's a current matter that the whole of South Africa is interested in, where the office of the Auditor General is being named as by CPS and the court. If the Auditor General can very briefly at some stage just tell us, you know, have they played this kind of role before, and why is their role being called upon in terms of how much and increases and things like that? You can do it out of the meeting or in the meeting, but I just thought it's important for us as a committee that has oversight to find out whether it's within the purview of the office to make those kind of judgments. Thank you.
When the time arrives, AG, it'll be your call. Can we deal with the minutes? Otherwise, it's going to derail us. Can we deal with the minutes? When we hand over to you, you can do all those things. Please, sir, if you don't mind. Page number one of the minutes of the 29th of November, 2016. Any changes to page number one? Any changes to page number two of the minutes?
Thank you, Chair. Yes, just the spelling of my surname in item 3.1 and 3.2, that the first G should be omitted. It's spelled correctly elsewhere in the document. Those two places should be corrected. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Apologies for that, sir. We've corrected that. Any other changes on page number two? If none, can I have somebody move for the adoption of the minutes? Thank you, Honourable Wani. Second for the minutes. The Honourable Singh does, and the minutes are duly adopted. That deals with the minutes. AG, you've heard members saying they have some sort of time constraints. It's 9:15. Can we, I don't know how long you require. We had given you just over an hour, according to our discussion, from 9:10 to 11 o'clock, and that's just under 2 hours. Can we stick to that time at least, so it gives us half an hour to have discussions if necessary, and then members will have half an hour to have a discussion, and we can always continue with it. Or am I working on the wrong one? Sorry, I'm working on the wrong one. Cindy is saying that you were given from 9 till 10, but it's fine, we can still give you till 10, that it gives us half, it gives us an hour to have a discussion if necessary. So we'll hand over to you, AG. We have honourable members got, and I'm assuming you're going to talk to this document. This is a document. Members have this document. AG will talk to that document. AG, over to you, and also feel like responding to Honourable Singh's intervention. It's up to you.
Thank you very much, Chair, and good morning to all the members of the committee. We certainly are quite pleased to have this opportunity to speak to SCOWAC on largely matters pertaining to our mandate and how we carry out our mandate in terms of the Public Audit Act. Before I get to the detail of the presentation we've prepared, Honourable Singh has already indicated an interest in our response to what has been in the public domain. Let me at the outset say that we do not normally comment, as you would have seen, we were silent on matters of that nature when they came up in the public domain. Largely because if you look at the principle surrounding how we do our work, it often dictates that we should not be involved in activities that are carried out by management, because we have an overall responsibility at the tail end of the expenditure to independently report on it. So if we were to be part of a mechanism to oversee and to implement whatever it may be, just imagine how it would be if we have to raise findings against ourselves, effectively. So it will mean that whatever findings we have to raise, a third party might be justified in questioning our objectivity, because it is the same environment on which we are reporting, where we would have been expected to exercise that which belongs to management. So from a management of conflict of interest, we normally have to separate those issues. But as far as the matter at hand is concerned, like all of us, I think we are waiting with great anticipation for the outcome of that process as it is being handled within the judiciary, and we'll take guidance from that principle, whatever it is that we might have to do going forward. Depending on the outcome of the judgment, we would exercise our responsibilities as guided by our rules of independence, so that we do not find ourselves involved in articulating something that we are supposed to independently pronounce on. So that's the principle. If that helps, I'll then Chair, move to the subject matter for today. And Chair, as you have correctly indicated, we coming to you after we had released our PFMA report last year. And it was clear that there's quite a big interest in the public domain about what then happens after the Auditor General has pronounced on their audit outcomes. And there were a couple of suggestions that came, if we recall, from the launch at the media conference, where we had some views and thoughts coming from, among others, the chair of the committee at the time and other commentators, to the effect that it may well be necessary to have a look at what the Public Audit Act provides, as well as whether it is a strong enough mechanism to deal with issues of consequence as far as audit outcomes are concerned. So if I go through the slide presentation, Chair, I'll try and deal with some of the issues just as a reminder so that we can build the context as to where we are going. So one of the things that we've looked at in the whole journey that we have been on as an audit office has been to once again reflect on what exactly are the benefits of an external audit as we see them. And among others, it's obviously about the promotion of credibility of information that is provided through financial statements and annual reports. It is also about giving momentum to the transformation of the financial management disciplines in the public sector. And you'll see this trend coming through our strategic plans since we've developed the one that we're working on since 2014, to say that we as an office, we also have an aspiration to contribute to strengthening financial management disciplines in the public sector. And also, as we have, as we will demonstrate in the presentation as well, we take very seriously our role in addition to expressing opinions on financial statements, and that being to strengthen the accountability systems, to strengthen oversight and governance within the public sector, as well as provide insights that will facilitate the foresight of decision makers as they look at how finances are managed and how those things overall impact on the lives of citizens in terms of appropriated monies. Are they going towards the intended programs and projects? So that's effectively what we think the external audit evaluation process provides as a benefit. And we've seen quite a lot of these coming back into a number of interactions in Parliament, varying from the inquiries at the SABC to matters pertaining to other entities within the public sector, where issues that we highlight in our reports pertaining to the strength or otherwise of financial management, as well as matters relating to the inappropriate expenditures like irregular expenditure, wasteful and fruitless expenditure. So those have always characterized the kind of work that we report on as a way of trying to strengthen the hand of those that are charged with accountability and promoting transparency in handling finances. So that's what we've seen ultimately as the overall lasting benefit that an external auditor provides, not only in our jurisdiction, but also there are lessons that we have picked from other jurisdictions as to the relevance of these benefits in the pursuit of public objectives. Chair, while we are doing this, I'm hoping that what has been presented is readable on your side. But I hope that you can get a better font, because I tried to look at this one where we put a white ink on this kind of background, and it's quite difficult to make up the words. But let me quickly deal with what we're trying to do in this slide. We're once again trying to elevate the real essence of what an annual audit is about while we are having this conversation, so that we can refresh our memories that when we do an audit from our side, it's always based on terms that have been agreed with the management of the entity that we audit, which means that nobody is taken by surprise as to the issues that are going to be examined in an audit, because our standards require that we must reduce our terms of engagement with the client so that they can agree to those terms. So first of all, there's a level of predictability in terms of the things that need to be prepared for an audit. And also the next thing that we do, we take all of those conversations that we have with our auditees and use the tools that we have developed through the standards of auditing to perform assessment of risk and assess the extent to which an entity is exposed to issues of financial mismanagement or inaccurate financial reporting. Once we have identified those risks in an audit process, we obviously are expected to respond to them. And the best way that we respond to them as auditors is to sharpen our tools to be able to detect the things that could potentially compromise accurate financial reporting. So that's what we do on a constant basis, to make sure that when we go and target certain areas that we are going to audit, it is based on a good understanding of how a particular business operates. It is based on an understanding of the risk environment in which that particular entity operates. If an entity operates in a major cash distribution environment, one would expect a lot of controls and activities around cash management rather than management of vehicles, if vehicles are an insignificant part of that business. However, if you are auditing a bus company, you probably will be looking at expertise that will follow through issues of risk pertaining to movable assets that might or might not continue to be in operation, because somebody can bump a bus and dump it somewhere and nobody knows that it is not generating the revenue. So those are the type of different responses that we put into an audit based on what are the issues at risk. The same would apply to a company, for example, like the property management entity that is within the public sector and public works environment, where it is the property management entity of the state. And so one would be focusing on the risks associated with non-recovery of rental income from properties that belong to the state, which are supposed to generate rental. So that's what we mean when we say we tailor every audit that we do to the circumstances of that entity and report ultimately in the audit report, where we highlight, among others, some of the deficiencies and the issues that we found not to be working as designed, or where we highlight issues that are supposed to be in place which have not been put in place. So that's what that whole slide, the green, red and orange on the one side, is about. It's about explaining that whole process, so that at times when we engage on the audit outcomes chair in the public domain, it's always misunderstood to be an investigation, in the sense that there's an allegation that we are responding to. Whereas in an audit process, we are not responding to an allegation. We are responding to a risk that is permanently in place in terms of inappropriate reporting on financial management or financial statements. Having said that, because of the ever-present risk of potential fraud and misstatement in financial statements, we take further steps to ensure that we bring into the planning of an audit people who have got investigative experience as well as forensic skills, so that when we develop the audit procedures that we do, we can sharpen them with those knowledge bases and methodologies that will be available to forensic experts. So we do not take the eye off the area of potential risk of fraud. And that's what really that other slide is trying to say that even if we achieve what we call a clean audit, if one looks at the bottom box on the right-hand side, we are reflecting in these clean audit some of the very important issues that need to be played, either by leadership of the institution or by the financial and performance management disciplines within finance, within supply chain, within the financial reporting environment, as well as profile the need for the audit committee and the internal audit to be strengthened in order to ensure that the good financial disciplines are maintained and so on. So that is the overall work that we try to achieve when we do audits. They are not only just about expressing the opinion, it's also about reflecting on the substantive and qualitative issues that need to be promoted in order to achieve credible financial reporting in the system. So that's the landscape, Chair, within which we do these audits. And I guess one of the things that is also clear, if one looks at the top two boxes where we speak about the inherent limitations of an audit. And I think one of them that I think I need to highlight up front so that we can ventilate on it as we go forward is the fact that because it is a risk-based process, meaning that you first identify the risks that you want to deal with and your response will be pointed in the direction of mitigating those risks. Now, one of the limitations is that the internal control environment is designed by management and is supervised by management. So if the internal control discipline is compromised and there is collusion within management, the chances that an auditor will pick up that situation is also limited, in the sense that when two people collude in an internal control environment, it means the one who was supposed to check did not properly check what they were meant to check from that which is being done by the other person. So which means it can be permanently hidden from an auditor. Say, for example, there's a contract that has been signed to develop a particular piece of land with a huge amount of money. If that expenditure has not been incurred and nobody in management discloses that fact, the auditor will be none the wiser as far as circumstances of that nature are concerned. And that's why when we look at an audit and we look at some of the major risks, one of the major risks in an audit is completeness. To what extent can you arrive at a conclusion that all the minutes of the meeting that should have been available have all been made available? Because some of the meetings will be special meetings and meetings that have not been scheduled. So from an auditor's point of view, the ability to mitigate the completeness risk is very high, because you depend also on the trustworthiness of the people who are running the system. So if there is an intention to hide certain things, it will always limit the ability of an auditor to come to a conclusion. And that's why the conclusion of an audit report, if you look at all financial statements, whether in the public sector or in the private sector, they are always about expressing an opinion on fair presentation, as compared to absolute accuracy. So there's a distinction of degree, and there's a degree of confidence that the auditors have applied to the financial statements, that if anybody looks at these financial statements to the extent of, let's say, 80%, a lot of the things that ought to have been placed have indeed been put in place, rather than every single transaction that ought to have been accounted for has been accounted for. So that's the distinction, because we express an opinion on fair presentation of the financial statement, not on absolute accuracy of all the financial statements. Because if it was the latter, then it would mean that we must examine every single transaction that happened every day for the 365 days on which we are reporting, which is impossible. So that's the gap, I think, that we are dealing with here, because we're coming from an angle that says for the greater part of the 20% that we may not have seen, we will apply our professional judgment based on our competence and technical capacity to understand that environment in the big picture. So there's an element of judgment that comes with the evaluation of that evidence that we would have seen. Hence, I'm saying that all opinions on financial statements based on our mandate are about the fair presentation of financial statements. It's a good level of assurance in the sense that it assists in many ways. One, it enforces the discipline for people to put put in place, documentary processes as well as controls in the environment, because they know they are going to be checked, because they know somebody will come and request evidence of a document that sometimes they would not have been comfortable to surface. And they know that if they don't surface that document and it is significant in the context of the financial statements, they may attract a disclaimer of an opinion. So if they are disclaimed and there's no consequence for that disclaimer, meaning that they can hide all contracts as much as they want if they don't, if they know nothing is going to happen after the disclaimer of an opinion has been issued. So that's one of the benefits that comes with this audit, because it is a proactive control mechanism that makes sure that those that are put in the line of accountability to look after the finances do what is expected. And I think it is important to recognize that limitation, among others, to say that we are not able to see all transactions, but our risk approach to an audit will always influence us to go towards the most significant and material transactions that have taken place in that particular entity. So that is a level of assurance that we think an audit could bring and does bring in a number of environments. Now, I just wanted to speak about an area which obviously flows from the previous slide, Chair, where after we have concluded on these audits and we have expressed an opinion on them, we make findings in areas where deficiencies have been identified in the manner in which finances are being handled. And I think members of the committee in various roles that you play, you will be familiar with a number of these reports that we issue. Management reports, which normally provide not only the detail of what we found, but we also highlight the root causes behind the failure of that particular internal control. And we highlight the specific steps that need to be taken by management in order for them to address the root cause. So that's what we normally write in our management reports. We don't leave it hanging. We discuss with them when we make the finding and we make a recommendation, because this finding to us, when we look at the financial statements, if it is allowed to continue, it has the potential to have a corrosive effect on the financial control environment. And I was listening to the Minister of Finance Chair on Tuesday speaking about Section 216 of the Constitution, which prescribes treasury control measures that need to be put in place to prevent the recurrence of these corrosive effects, which are normally picked up in financial statements. So there's authority in the highest law of the land with regards to where this is coming from. Ours, as we articulated in our audits in the Public Audit Act, is really the implementation side of it, but it comes right back from that part of the Constitution that deals with treasury control and the necessary processes that need to be put in place to prevent what I guess is known, that when there are too many hands through which finances flow, some things drop through the cracks and some of them get diverted away from where they were intended. And we're coming from that angle when we raise these management reports. It's not nice to do's, but it's those things that if are left uncorrected, they could have the potential to corrode the effectiveness with which programs would be implemented in the future. The next thing that we have also introduced, Chair, and this I'm giving a feedback now in terms of the work that we have been driving in the office over the last 8 to 10 years, going back to the time when Terence was in office, where we introduced a program, and again, this program of quarterly key engagements with accounting officers and executive authorities, was to evaluate the status of these internal controls on an ongoing basis, so that we can bring some insight to them. If there are issues that they do not understand, we can provide clarity to them. But at the same time, we also leave them with a scorecard as to our assessment of their internal controls in financial management as well as the extent to which they are providing supervisory controls over the activities of those that are handling finances. We have also over this last decade extensively engaged with public accounts committees and portfolio committees in all provinces, in municipalities as well as nationally, to highlight some of the issues that I have spoken about regarding the potential benefits that could be derived from increasing the extent of oversight in financial management. And that has been complemented over a number of years with roadshows, which we still do to this day. Just this week, we had engaged at about three different provinces with all the recently elected mayors from August, where we shared the audit outcomes for this cycle of the MFMA province by province, where at sessions that are convened by the premiers called the Provincial Coordinating Council with all the mayors and the municipal managers, where we share with them through these roadshows the history behind these audit outcomes as well as the accountability that is expected of them as councillors to activate the required controls to prevent financial losses in local government. So those roadshows have become part of our annual agenda, because we are of the view that it is also a good discipline that we speak to those that are responsible for these finances directly before we speak about them in the public domain, so that there is no confusion about where we're coming from when we engage publicly. So that has been one of those foundational strengths, Chair, I would say, that we have enjoyed over time, that we do not take anyone by surprise when we come to the final launch of our audit report, because we would have preceded that announcement in the public domain with direct interactions with all affected. The media has been a space that has assisted us to also take the message down, and I think that looking at the engagements in the release of the PFMA in November last year, there was quite an extensive interaction coming from direct writers, analysts, and many other people in phone-in programs who were starting to be pointed at what needs to be done in order to avert the growing trend of negative audit outcomes. So there's that part of the journey over the last 10 years that the area of influence that we as an audit office have has expanded to, let alone the door-to-door visits, which were part of a journey that took us to every one of the municipalities over a period of about 4 years during the time Terence was in office, and that has engaged those institutions, even though mayors may have changed and councillors may have changed, but the issues that we highlighted through that journey have remained an institutional priority, as we see some of them in their individual development plans that characterize their activities. The issue of the targets around providing credible financial management systems continues to be a priority. So we think that the message ultimately of the audit office over time has entrenched itself in quite a number of significant areas, both the constitutional structures as well as non-constitutional structures. And that engagement also includes our interactions with institutions of higher learning, because that's partly a source of our own talent. But in addition to that, we often get good ideas from those people because they are in institutions that are about panel beating the best ways to innovate all manner of issues, including financial management and so on. Our working relationship with National Treasury, the Accounting Standards Board, and the public service structures in the form of the DPSA, every year, whenever we release our MFMA or PFMA audits, we always have a Troika engagement, and that engagement is those ministries that have a transversal responsibility over a number of disciplines that affect us from an audit point of view. And those three will be National Treasury, because they are the custodian of the national purse, the Department of Public Service and Administration, because that's where the instruments and the people employed in the states are governed from, and some of the issues that we pick up in these audits have got a direct relevance to adherence to human resource related matters because of issues of competence, issues of recruitment, issues of retention of skills, vacancies, and all of those which, if not dealt with from a policy clarity point of view, sometimes will affect the way we report and the stuff that we report on. And this extends to the likes of people who are doing business with state entities where they are directly or indirectly interested in the outcome of those transactions. And the performance monitoring and evaluation function, from the point of view that we also report on the performance of the departments and entities, some of the guidance and policies that govern that area, we interact extensively with those. And that, with COGTA, it goes without saying that the area of local government as a function in government is also largely what we engage COGTA on when we release audit outcomes for local government. So that's the level of interaction, Chair, if I take from those audit outcomes and then what? So we've really invested in our systems to ensure that every year we create this predictability, we create this level of simplifying this message so that people are not think this is a mystery. You know, how am I going to deal with these complex financial management words and all of that? Our interactions are about empowering those that are supposed to act as best they can in dealing with the audit recommendations. Chair, just a quick one. If then one takes one's eye into where we've been over the years and we're examining the area of the quality of financial statements, and you look at where we were in 2014, right down, 2004, right down to 14-15. That's the layout in terms of the type of audit opinions. If you just look at the area of financial statements, we have seen over the years, if one takes the 10-year view, that the area of the financial management and reporting accurately on financial statements in the sense that they are unqualified, there's been quite a significant shift there. At least a lot of the entities over the years have taken heed of the recommendations to focus on employing people who have got the requisite competences in finance departments and financial management. But however, we still have a remainder of entities that are still continuing to be qualified, which we will deal with some of the substantive issues behind it later. As well as the disclaimers, we see that there has been quite a big shift if one looks back to the period 2004 to 2005, the red bar, where we had well over 150 in total of municipalities and departments, both PFMA and MFMA, where the level of disclaimer was at an almost very high in those 2004-05 era. And now, looking at it in 2014-15, it has even come closer to half of 100 from somewhere around 150. So that's been quite a shift that we have seen over the years, as on the back of some of the elevated transparency with which some of these issues of financial management are engaged. However, if one looks at one other side of the equation, Chair, and as you would recall, when we speak about clean audits in that slide, the first one that I looked at, where we clarify what a clean audit is, it often has the three components. One of those components has to do with compliance with legislation with regards to financial matters, and we still see quite a significant number of entities not complying with that legislation. And the five-year trend that we're profiling here is clearly indicating that we still have quite a lot of entities who do not observe the likes of supply chain management rules, who do not observe other prescripts, including things like paying suppliers within the prescribed period and other matters pertaining to irregular expenditure that attach to the entities that we audit. So there's still quite a huge area, much as the financial management discipline, Chair, is commendable in terms of the strides that have been made. The catch here is, if I may just use an example, if I'm given 500,000 to purchase a truck in a municipality, which truck must be made available for refuse removal as part of the environmental management of a municipality, and I'm the authority involved, or I'm the mayor, and I decide that I'm not going to buy a truck, I'm going to buy a Jetta, a sedan, with that amount of money, and I decide that maybe by the chair, because when I put a debit in the books, it's going to be debit vehicles. Anyway, so a truck is a vehicle. It's just that in the fixed asset register, it is classified as a commercial vehicle. So it's classified differently. But a Jetta is also a vehicle. So the accounting entry is debit asset, regardless of whether it's a truck or a Jetta. The transaction is debit asset, credit bank for both of them, because you would have taken 500,000 out of bank, regardless of whether you were buying a truck or a Jetta. Credit 500,000, bank, debit asset. Could be a truck, it could be a Jetta. The catch where it is, coming back to this slide, is that the chances that we are going to subject that purchase of a Jetta to a transparent, competitive supply chain management process are limited, because you are deviating from that which was planned to be purchased with that 500,000 anyway. So there's no incentive for you to bring this to the public attention when you know that you are actually going to buy a Jetta for yourself instead of buying a truck. So what I'm saying, therefore, is that the accounting entry is the easiest thing to fix. We've recognized that progress here in terms of that has been quite easy to deal with that. But what remains is the fact that you actually did not buy a truck, you bought a Jetta. So you still are not complying with supply chain management. But secondly, the third component of the clean audit, in terms of the three elements, is about reporting accurately on your objectives that you have set against which you are going to spend this money. If the predetermined objective is to demonstrate that part of your performance information is the number of loads of refuse removal per month, the chances are that you won't have that record because you can't remove waste with a Jetta. So you can't do it. The chances are that you will find that litter all over the place in town because there's no truck to remove it. And that's why I think it's important to understand the three elements that come together when we speak about clean audits, when we speak about the continuous prevalence of high levels of non-compliance, is about that kind of circumstance. We may have received an asset which is not necessarily that which we wanted, because we had to circumvent the supply chain management process, but at the same time, we do not have recorded predetermined information on which we report on the performance for the year, because there's no track to remove waste, and therefore, we will fail that objective because we are driving around in a Jetta. Right. So following, therefore, Chair, because of those high levels of non-compliance with financial management regulations in some instances, you then find a growing trend of irregular expenditure, as depicted on the slide there. You'll see that there's a major jump somewhere between 2013 and 2012. That is largely an isolated, as you can see on the slide, item that was a historical, I think Honorable Singh will remember, on the accounts of the property management trading entity, when it was catching up with that big 31 billion irregular expenditure that was an accumulation when they were cleaning up their environment. But the reality is that the trend of irregular expenditure, fruitless and wasteful expenditure, on the back of the persistent non-compliance with financial management regulations, as reflected here, has also been trending upwards. And I think when we reported the last time on irregular expenditure, it was still a significant amount in terms of the amounts involved. And it is that reporting on that type of expenditure that sometimes the issue of consequences comes, because people want to know, well, this amount of irregular expenditure, if it is diversion from the rules that are set, what is being done about it? What is happening to the people who are responsible for it? Up to now, as far as we do our work and our mandate, we largely report it through our management reports, as we have indicated, to those that are charged with governance to take it to the next level, to investigate the circumstances behind these levels of non-compliance with financial management rules. When that investigation happens, it will trigger a number of outcomes, one of which could be a condonement of that expenditure because of circumstances that would have been clarified in council or in whatever oversight structure, or it could be an outcome that attaches the responsibility to those that have facilitated this without due care. That's what is significantly absent currently, that next step, the step that is about. So these instances of irregular expenditure in terms of the record and the detail that has been provided, what actions are we taking on them? And that's why the issue of, in the absence of consequences, there's a chance that these instances of non-compliance with financial management regulations are likely to continue. And I think in bringing this discussion to this level, we come with that background understanding to say that this irregular expenditure, if it has to come down as well as it, if it has to support the level of compliance with financial regulations, there's got to be some level of consequence that will come in order to avert it from growing further and further, because the risk of misappropriation of finances becomes prevalent and dominant in an environment that is characterized by a growing trend of this type of expenditure with limited or no decisive action that follows after the infractions have been committed. We've also, Chair, looked at a couple of areas that could potentially facilitate private benefit, and I guess some of it is largely in the area of conflict of interests, where you find that some concerns that we have raised, for example, in relation to people inside the institution having an interest in the work of a particular supplier. And some of the deviations come as a result of that, because there's nothing that's written down when it comes to those things, but things never get subjected to a tender process, or certain thresholds create multiple transactions just because we don't want to reach that threshold of 500,000 in order to be, you know, compulsorily required to subject it to a competitive process. Then we can easily double up those amounts and make sure that we make multiple sourcing of goods and services at levels below that limit. That facilitates that type of issue when you've got a prevalence of conflict of interest. Potentially that could divert the financial resources to preferred service providers under circumstances where there's no proper or accountability and oversight. So when we raise these issues in terms of the limitations in supply chain management, we are calling for those that are charged with oversight to get to the bottom of what is it that is driving that type of activity so that they can take the necessary steps that are prescribed in the PFMA. Chair, the basic issues really that we've picked up as far as the challenges that still prevent audit outcomes, as I said, if there's no responsiveness to the recommendations that we make, the chances are that those risks will continue to flourish in the environment. If there are no consequences, performance when it's poor, it's not tolerated. And if there are vacancies in key positions, then it increases the level of neglect of internal controls in the environment. And of course, we've highlighted in the document, I'm not going to go through each one of them. We've seen these throughout the reports that we have raised over the period. Let me just chase to the latter part of the presentation. One of the things that we have introduced, Chair, recently to enhance our level of interaction with the entities that we audit has been what we call the key control engagements, which is about a regular assessment of the status of accounting records in all the entities that we audit. We've now done a pilot as we speak about this slide. This is a slide that reflects this journey, which is about intensifying our interactions on a quarterly basis with the entities that we audit, where we say, for example, under the financial management bar, if I use an example for that one, these are the eight, if you like, key focus areas that our key control engagement is about. This is where we go to an entity and say, We're not going to wait until you close the books in 12, in month number 12. We want at the end of the second or the third quarter of the year that you are currently working on to get you, the accounting officer, the chief financial officer, and as well as the head of supply chain management and the head of internal audit at a minimum. Come around to an engagement with us where we ask you, what is the status of your accounting and administrative controls in your environment currently, up to this period, up to the second or up to the third quarter, so that we can assess whether you have in place the basic account reconciliations that are required to assess the accuracy of account balances that are going to be subjected to an audit at the end of the year. So that's what this key control engagement is about. It's about assessing the status of accounting records at that particular point and to highlight to the accounting officer the areas that are potentially going to derail them if they don't fix them come the end of the financial year. So it's an early warning mechanism to say that in the past we know that you did not have an asset register, and at the end of the last audit you committed that you have put a budget aside to put an asset register in place. And part of this engagement is going to be about, do you now have that asset register? Let's not wait to find out at the end of the year that you don't have it. Do you now have it? So that we can assess upfront whether the commitments that you had made on the basis of the recommendations that were made, have they been carried out? So that we can highlight these prior to the year end to those that are charged with oversight to say, here are the potential derailers to what improvements in financial management are going to be, and they require your attention as leadership to act on them prior to getting to the final stages of doing the audit. So we've done a pilot on this at about 29 different entities right up to the beginning of this year, and the trend that we have seen is quite encouraging in the sense that it brings the consciousness for people to look after their accounting records during the year rather than worrying about it when the audit is about to happen. Because if they don't account for their transactions and they don't reconcile their books, we are going to highlight it to those that they report to. It depends on them if they are going to act on it. But ours is to give an early warning signal to say, if you do not have a chief financial officer in place and that vacancy that has been there for the past year continues, the chances are that you are going to discover in the last month that you need to engage the services of an external service provider, and you're going to spend a lot of money, and most of the time you may not even have the documents to substantiate the transactions you've entered into because of vacancies. So that's the effort, Chair, that we are putting into the system to try and intensify the investment that we have put in the system already. And also the amendments that we have considered in improving our audit methodology, where we bring the insights of our other colleagues in the office, the likes of your information system auditor, where we know that there's a high level of information systems risk, or we bring the insights of investigators, where we know there's a high risk of fraud and error in financial statements, as well as where we bring the efforts of our performance auditors, where we know there are a number of funded programs that are being implemented via grants where certain issues of efficiency and effective delivery of the likes, for example, in local government, the urban road transport networks where the bus systems are being introduced in a number of towns, we're starting to evaluate how the implementation of the capital projects around those things are being done in local government. We've just recently done another one on water delivery infrastructure. So, Jay, that's the work that we have been doing over time insofar as responding to what is our mandate, as well as the historical experience and the outcomes so far and what we consider to be the priorities of where the office is. And this is basically the first part of the presentation that I was just looking at, just to give a background to all of that. And Chair, this was prompted, as it were, by the many suggestions that have come that say, but if you do all of this, there's very little that we would ask of you in terms of additional work that needs to be done. Let's have a look and see whether you've got sufficient powers to effect some of the things that ought to be effected, which currently are not being effected for a number of reasons. So we just wanted to share a couple of things, Chair, which we picked up, among other things, when we looked at this area of addressing consequence management as far as our part of the work is concerned. We looked, among others, at the at the judgment that was handed down last year via the Nganza matter. And part of the issues that we picked up from there were largely the areas that reflected on Chapter 9 institutions, where we speak about the need for appropriate mechanisms to follow up on audit recommendations. I think it was highlighted very prominently in sections of that judgment that dealt with the Chapter 9 institutions. There's also another matter which was quite attractive to us, Chair, where the Chief Justice in that report of the judgment said that, in fact, not in that report, this was in a paper that the Chief Justice shared with us when we hosted our Capacity Building Committee meeting last year, October, where he made the point that we should not expect the implementation of our recommendation if one who must implement are the authors of whatever must be fixed through our recommendations. That was quite a very telling issue, that you are raising the recommendations, but you are directing them to the people who are the authors of the same findings that you are reporting on. How do you navigate that particular area? And there were also some that remained, which were about re-emphasizing the role of Parliament in terms of oversight. And also the fact that there should be no expectation that the parliamentarians will ensure the implementation of AG's recommendations, because they may have different skills when it comes to the type of issues, among others, that need to be dealt with. Let's say, for example, they are difficult, generally recognized accounting practice issues that need to be sorted out with technical people in the departments. I think that is the context here which speaks about they've got different skills to effect oversight, but when it comes to some of the technical issues, it might need the AG to deal with those issues, as it happens on an annual basis with National Treasury and the affected departments. One of the issues that also has picked up, Chair, was the fact that the AG is also best skilled to ensure that the recommendations are implemented with satisfaction, and that the AG must supplement the role and of the legislatures and strengthen their hand to fulfill their duties. So these are some of the issues that we picked up, Chair, in that paper, which were quite pointed because this was directed at an audience of quite a number of AGs that were in the room, and it was highlighting and local experience, but bringing into the equation some of the similar experiences of other jurisdictions. As I said earlier on, Chair, the issues that were reflected as far as the Chapter 9 institutions are concerned in that judgment created the opportunity for us to take some steps to look at how and what can be enhanced in our own mandate to facilitate an enhanced level of consequence management in the public sector, as well as the fact that when we looked at our purpose in terms of the review of our powers, in the light of what I've explained as far as our mandate provides, what I've explained as far as the limitations of an audit are concerned, we felt that when we look at the purpose of the review from our point of view now, Chair, we said it must be about strengthening the AG's ability to restore the administrative and financial integrity of systems and processes to facilitate service delivery and the pursuit of goals for which public money has been appropriated. And this is very important for us because we're not seeking for the engagement on our powers beyond what the original intention of an audit was about. An audit is normally about restoring the administrative and financial integrity of the systems rather than effecting punishment on anybody, because it does not have those powers, it does not have that appeal nor the authority, nor do we seek to get that. I think ours is to start thinking about what can we have in terms of the powers to ensure that once exercised, it will bring us closer to restoring the administrative and financial integrity of the systems that we are responsible for auditing. So when we look at the project, we initiated an interaction chain where we look at the areas that we are going to look at, and we came up with a number of options that we felt, based on the Public Audit Act, will be the likely route to take. Firstly, if I look at the fourth bullet, we looked at issues, Chair, that could strengthen the referral mechanism. Let me take an example of what we mean by this. If one looks at the mandate of our institution, we are required to audit and to report. But if you look at the mandate of an institution like the Public Protector, it is tasked with investigating, reporting, and attaching appropriate remedial action. So there are three elements to their mandate. So what we are envisaging around a referral mechanism, for example, is a situation where we say, if we determine that an entity that gets a repeated disclaimer, as an example of an opinion, after we have signed that particular report, and this is, let's say, instance number two, or even if it's instance number one, I'm just using an example, and we say this is an intolerable outcome because it means that the auditee has not surfaced the required documentation to the auditor, but the auditor does not have the instrument to enforce that particular entity to bring forth the required audit evidence. What it means is that once, and we are proposing here, among others, in terms of the stuff that we are busy working on, a mechanism where within a specified period, let's say we sign financial statements by the 31st of July, and we, if we say within 30 days from the date of signing that particular audit report, that report must be handed over to an investigative agency, for example, like the Public Protector, who will then investigate the circumstances surrounding why that particular documentation was not made available and make the appropriate finding that comes with the proposed remedial action about that particular entity, so as to prevent the recurrence of instances of that nature without them ever being investigated. Hence, the repeat of the same type of disclaimer of opinion in some instances. So that is the kind of mechanism that we are looking at, so that it is up to us to comply with the requirement in our Act, which says within this specified period, once you signed an opinion of this nature, or if there are issues within the reports that you have signed which point to the potential abuse of supply chain management systems, which because of the limitations of your audit you would not have been able to investigate, you have a mechanism through your Act to refer directly those matters to agencies within the public sector. It could be the CBDI, it could be the SIU, it could be the Public Protector, depending on which one is the relevant agency to handle that matter henceforth. So that's the matter that we are putting out as part of strengthening the ability of an audit to say it is not in the hands directly of the people that are supposed to effect this consequence in all instances. There are certain categories of repeated infractions that will attract the attention of investigative agencies who will be required to report within a period of time so that there's transparency in respect of the circumstances contributing to a repeated irregular expenditures at certain levels and whether it is to do with disclaimers of opinion. So it is those categories of items that we believe if there's a direct focus on them and the audit office is given the authority to direct them, it will move us closer to that objective which I mentioned in terms of the second bullet, which is about restoring the administrative and financial integrity of the systems within a reasonable period of time. So that's the one major issue, I guess, that we wanted to start this conversation about, Chair. And And there's a number of other subsidiary matters which I thought for time limitations it may just drag us into long discussions. But while we are looking at that area in terms of strengthening the mandate, we also are thinking about cleaning up a number of other areas in terms of the possible amendments that have been outstanding over the last 7 years, which we would want to have an opportunity to also engage the committee on. So on the back of this, after we had taken on this responsibility, we also took steps to engage the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor so that they can facilitate with us how we would frame something like that if we were to get the nod of the committee in respect of that. And there are certain issues that the Chief State Law Advisor has already engaged with us on, and we are already in work in progress with them in terms of dealing with what could be put into the Public Audit Act to effect what we are wanting to put on the table. And then there's other amendments that we have just flagged for discussion. A lot of them are to strengthen matters around the governance. For example, appointment of audit committee, there's just a couple of issues, as well as to clarify the issues that came out in the review of Chapter 9 and other institutions in what is now known as the Kadasmal report, which dealt with clarification of certain areas of the mandate. These are largely coming from that past, where there's a mandate to conduct performance audits, but it could be better clarified. Conduct of investigations, it was highlighted in that report as another, as well as the performance of international audits and so on. And we've also flagged the issue of collection of fees, and I think that one comes from constantly evaluating the environment to check whether there are any issues that could trip us in terms of the two elements of the mandate. As members will recall, the one element is really the administrative autonomy, if you like, in terms of our ability to make decisions to employ the people that we believe possess the minimum competences to do the work. And that's one of the organizational strengths that we enjoy. The other one is the financial independence, which is about ability to raise the fees, but there's a constant risk of non-recovery of those fees because of the direct invoicing that we do, but the reality also that some institutions are starting to feel the pinch with regards to the financial fortunes, as we know from the fiscal constraints that were articulated in the budget. The issue of the collection of fees, as we have engaged our reports every year with the committee, has now become a prominent matter in terms of the risk. The one thing we do not want to fall into is a situation where, as we have to do these issues in terms of our mandate, we start falling short with respect to the resources required to continue to do this kind of work. So we will be setting out in clear terms when we get the next opportunity with the committee. So we're just highlighting this so that you can start reflecting on them as well, but we will share with the committee what we are proposing, what to be done to strengthen those. I'm not going to go through the detail of these checks, but that's basically what I've said as far as the performance audits are concerned. The mandate for the investigations will give you the detail, the international audit and the audit fees. Chair, that's the overall presentation I thought we will share with the committee, but I want to go back again and say that one of the key things that I think will determine how we make progress in this is to stay closer to the objective that we have set our review is about, which is what we have set out on bullet number 2 of that slide number 17. I think it's quite important to distinguish what powers mean. We're not wanting powers to arrest or to do anything of that sort, but we want powers that will enable us to have a mechanism that is transparent enough, which is also capable of holding us accountable as well. Because if we've got, let's say, a number of 55 disclaimers and we have signed off on those opinions, I think the committee will be in their right to ask the question next year, to what extent have you made progress with regards to the matters that we have handed over to those institutions that you had a referral mechanism to transfer them to, so that it's not about you cannot be the auditor and the investigator of the same things that you yourself audited, because you might be biased in terms of the conclusions that you reach. However, having said that, if one has to have that referral mechanism, I would like to also flag the fact that if one looks at that input that I shared now from the Chief Justice, there was no doubt that it comes with resources to have that mechanism in place, because if I have to worry another investigative institution because of its capacity, I must also enable them to do that work without being hindered by resources. So that if I say to them, if I give you this referral list of these particular entities to take further, I would like you to give me a report within 90 days. So there must be no issue about I do not have the resources to do it. If we are initiating this accountability mechanism, I think we should stand ready to pay for it. If someone from the SIU or from the public protector is going to put resources to it, we need to facilitate that to happen quickly, so that when we speak about consequences, at least we know that from our side we have closed that part of the loop. Thank you very much, Chair. I hope within the hour allocated, I've tried to paint the picture in terms of what we aspire to head towards as an institution, and we would want to interact with yourselves at different intervals so we can frame this as part of the outcomes of the journey towards strengthening our mandate. Thank you very much, Chair. I return to you.
Okay. Excuse me. Thank you, AG. Honourable members, there we have a taste of what the AG's thinking is in terms of strengthening his office, or the Office of the Auditor General of South Africa's effectiveness using the PAA, the Public Audit Act. So I'm going to allow members to exhale, comment, ask questions of clarity, and secondly also to suggest how we take it forward. Now, we could, in fact, take lots of these things as part of our strat plan, for instance, so that we ourselves can argue it and be in a better position, AG, to debate with you when the time comes, because we'll be seeing it for the first time. We've not applied our minds as a committee. But I'm sure members would have some initial comments on what the AG has said. So as you speak, you can speak on that, and also in terms, honourable members, of how we process this. My understanding, the AG is saying that you would want a serious discussion sometime in the future that actually says, are you agreeing with me that we go and change ABC in the act as it stands currently? So I'll come back to you. So when we respond, one is to ask questions here, and secondly, how do we prepare ourselves to have that serious discussion? I don't think we'll be in a position today to have that serious discussion, and I'm suggesting we can start it in your strat plan session. AG, before I give it to members, you want to make a comment?
Oh, Chair, sorry, I meant to say something on the point that you have just raised regarding the timing and the urgency of this. Obviously, we take into account that you are now almost 2 years away from the end of the current administration, and also the reality is that conversation about so what after these audit outcomes has become the permanent feature in the public domain. Otherwise, if it continues to remain outstanding for a period of time in this matter of strengthening the powers, it will be a major albatross, I guess, around the neck of the office, because the only way we can answer what happens to these audit outcomes is when what is expected to strengthen the hand of these consequences is effected. So there's that matter which, if we were to sit out in the public domain now and we present audit outcomes, it will almost become, more of the same, if you don't have that discussion taking root already. Thanks.
So you're lobbying for urgency for change. That's what you're lobbying for, basically. All right, let's allow members to comment. I have noted Ms. Carter, followed by
Okay.
Let's take everybody to comment initially. So let's maybe start with Ms. Carter, come this way, and then go that way. McLaughlin, Dubazane, and we'll end with you, Masangwan. Ms. Carter.
Thank you, Chair. You know, there's so much going wrong in many departments and SOEs. You know, we look at PetroSA, we look at SAA, we look at PRASA, and we look at SASA. And, you know, we need to ask, are these issues flagged well in advance? How are we following up on it that we do not have a surprises? Now, right there, I want to come in and say, especially under the chairmanship of our chairman, I absolutely believe that this committee cannot be a rubber stamp committee, and that we should be more active. I honestly feel where there is risk management reports like we are seeing with SASA now, it seems like if it only goes to the committee, things are not dealt with. But if the audit, the select committee on the auditor general, for example, get a risk management report of all the audits that were done right in the beginning, when it is actually issued, and not only when the departments, you know, when the actual departments discuss it, I think that could also really assist us. You know, what is important is that with the AG being a Chapter 9 institution, it is there to strengthen our constitutional democracy, and honestly not only there to check the accuracy of financial statements, but I would also say, but the financial management as well. So I think also just if maybe the AG can just say to us specifically on the SASA issue, you know, the warning signs, why does it come all of a sudden as such a big surprise to the minister and them to say that they only found out about it in September? You know, if we had that consequence management and the risk management report, we wouldn't have been in the situation we are in. Now, I just want to take you one step further, and that is, and I'm quite sure a lot of you have heard it before, I've been my history has been an ISO, okay? And I always say, if we look at work procedures, if in this committee specifically, I've said so many times, we should have a register of things that are going wrong to assist everywhere else. But unfortunately, I mean, it's just not happening. But what do we do? Say, for example, if you are ISO 9001 registered and things go wrong and you've got findings that it's affecting your systems and the procedures that are followed, they just go and they withdraw your certificate. And you're going to have to work hard to get it back. We have to find something there, whether it's going to affect the funds that they are receiving, but we've got to look at a mechanism the same as that type of mechanism. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And just thanks to the AG. Broadly speaking, what you're proposing is music to my ears, AG. It's been long a subject of discussion between myself and some of my colleagues that as a Chapter 9 institution, the Auditor General's office doesn't have enough teeth. You must get so frustrated where time after time you go with adverse findings, and just nothing happens. The next time you go there, nothing's changed. It's all still the same. So, yes, I'm fully in support of where you're going on this. Having had a look at in more detail at the specific proposals you come across, the one that concerns me a bit is the fee collection story where your advice has been you can't do that in terms of the Public Audit Act, but there'll have to be a Money Bills Act to affect that situation. And I have a concern because as with the, when Treasury stops funding to municipalities because they're not paying Eskom, and then Eskom stops the supply, you're punishing the payers rather than the person who's actually caused the problem. And I wouldn't want to advocate for a similar sort of situation here, where ultimately it's the ratepayer who's going to suffer because of some grant that's refused to the municipality because the municipality hasn't paid its audit fees. So I think one has to be very careful about how you go about this. Obviously, I'm very much in favour of you collecting the fees that are due to you, but it can't be at the cost of the ratepayer if he has done something wrong. Or the indigent citizen in the municipality who's got no influence in this thing in any event or in any way, but he gets punished because his municipality hasn't paid them their audit fees to the AG. So I think it's just something we're going to have to really look carefully at. But, Chair, I would propose that we move as quickly as we could into a situation where we can present an amended bill to the House. And so we'd need the state law advisors to get involved here quickly and draft whatever's necessary to give effect to those changes so that we can get it into the House and help address the AG's request that this be dealt with in an urgent manner. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you so much for the Auditor General's presentation. Mine, Chairperson, is not a question, but it's just to agree with what Auditor General is saying, because we have been saying this. Even last day, if you remember, we're sitting on in the old assembly where we said, seemingly you don't have enough teeth. That's actually how we have put it, which means we do agree with you that something has to be done. And one cannot assume that the country will remain as is for another 100 years. So the legislation has to be up and running and be effective to all the citizens to ensure that there is security. So, Chair, based on that, my proposal is that I've listened to what the AG is saying regarding, you know, the proposal made to the conduct performance audits and the rest. And I've just looked at this, because fortunately I had it. I was actually looking at it after I've spoken to Cindy exactly what would be the main discussion. And I realized that some of the things that we are requesting, they are within the Constitution, the section of the Constitution. And if we take them to the House, and we need to take it, when we come back in May, we must engage on this and take this thing to the House and test and see how it goes. But some of those functions that are within the Constitution, which means they need a two-thirds majority. However, though, if we use Section 20 of the PAA, and we try and put what you have just said, AG, should a particular entity receive disclaimer repeated, whatever, and AG is empowered to attach remedial action within, it doesn't, but if you can just move from section 4, because section 4 is going to delay us, Chairperson, because it's a constitution mandate given to the AG, section 4 of the Public Audit Act. So if you take it to the House, definitely going to demand the two-thirds majority, because we need to put in those functions that you are to also conduct the function on the international issues, Whereas if they go to the section 20 of the PAA, then it becomes the PAA section, which doesn't need the two-thirds majority. It needs 50 plus one. Then try and work around. You can work around. Look at it. You can actually work around and put all those things that you are saying, the level of the consequences, the remedial action, duration, if not that is not a thing happen, then this is what we recommend. Then you put those proposals. When we come back, I then propose, Chairperson, that when we come back, then we work on what we have proposed. I'm done, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, AG, and your team. Chair, I totally agree that there needs to be harsher consequences for those public entities and departments and municipalities that are transgressing financial management prescripts. I've read the speech by the Chief Justice and the comments by the AG of Kenya and Ms. Ross and our AG. And I see there's a suggestion there by the Chief Justice that we should look at, the first prize is constitutional amendment, then the second prize is statutory amendments. which will be the PAA, like you, my colleague is talking about. Now, whilst I fully agree that there has to be consequences, and there aren't enough, and this is why 23 years into our democracy, there are many serial offenders, departments and entities that are year in and year out not adhering to basic financial management precepts, keeping of documents, ensuring there's basic things, you know, where other countries have moved financial audits to performance audits. You know, New Zealand and others, they don't know what is a financial audit anymore because the finances and the record keeping is totally up to date. They're moving to performance audit, and that's what we should be moving towards. But I am still grappling in my mind, and that's why I like the suggestion you made, Chair, and other colleagues made, that we need to apply our minds and then come back with this, even though this state law advisor has supported some of the amendments. Whose responsibility is it for oversight of those departments and those municipalities? I'm thinking aloud. Are we not putting too much responsibility on the Office of the Auditor General to make a finding, follow the finding, police the finding, etc., etc., etc.? Now, even the public protector's findings now are taken on review. Almost all of it has been taken on review by people we know, not people we don't know. So it's from people within the system that are taking it on review. We don't want departments who are found to be wanting in terms of their financial management doing that, you know, if we give the AG the full authority. You see, my thinking is that the Office of the AG is the investigator. They investigate things that have gone wrong, right, and they make a finding. It's our responsibility as Parliament and as committees to ensure that we take the appropriate action against those departments and officials. And the law allows you to do that. The PFMA allows you to take action against heads of departments, etc., etc. We have not. So in all of this, the loud question I am asking all of us as Parliament, are we not abrogating our responsibilities of oversight by letting some of these things go through, even after we get a finding from the Auditor General, which says this department has done 1, 2, 3. What do? We have SCOPA, we have the Portfolio Committee, we make some recommendations, that's it. The next year, you go back and back and back and back. We found that even in the case of the SASA debacle, which Honourable Member Prater has spoken about, in the courts they've said the Portfolio Committee has failed in its duties. In the Ad Hoc Committee's report on SABC adopted by Parliament, it was said that the Portfolio Committee on Communications also failed to exercise its oversight responsibility. So the loud question I am asking all of us is, where should that responsibility lie? Who actually, you know, must bell the cat at the end of the day? Is it the Office of the Auditor General in terms of legislation, or is it us working with the Office of Auditor General while strengthening provisions in the PAA? Because we must not put the Office of the Auditor General into a situation where there's a conflict of interest and they become judge and jury. I'm thinking aloud. Policeman investigates, prosecutor prosecutes, judge decides. Right? That's my broad thinking on this matter. But saying that let's continue to apply our minds, let the Office of the AG respond when you give them an opportunity, let state law advisors apply their minds on this, and we take it forward from this. Thank you.
thank you, Chairperson, and also welcome the report. Do I understand the request to mean that we'll have to extend the mandate of the AG to follow up on issues of consequent management. Will they have capacity to do so? Don't we have other organs of state which are supposed to do that? probably we'll need another day to be workshopped about this matter, so that we also go into the PSMA and MFMA and their regulations. Because we might have that desire, but won't it have unintended consequences that the office of the AG become an executing arm of government and compete with the executive arm of government? It might not be for today, but as they say that the proposed amendment has been lying there for over 5 years or so, probably the sooner we get into the details of what they are proposing, the better. If they can go back to the state law advisors and put a document so that we can engage that document. Don't we have enough mechanisms within government or state to implement what the AG will have found in his auditor opinion? Because it means we are also going to employ a very big staff in the office of the AG to deal with what is being proposed. But I don't want to make any conclusion in that regard, Chairperson, because I need more workshop and look at other legislations in relation to what departments and state entities are supposed to do. In just for clarity question, in slide 6, which says implementation of recommendations, there's a bullet point 1, 2, 3, 4, where they talk about the roadshows and they talk about key ministers. Well, what is a key minister? Ministers not of the same status. To say key, I don't know what is it that they were qualifying. I've got an issue with that word key there before ministers. And also slide 15, Chairperson, on the review of the powers of the AG, Chief Justice of the Republic of South Africa. The last bullet there talks about our role as parliament, which is oversight. But it says that but we should not expect of them to ensure implementation of all AG's recommendations. They are differently skilled. Does the Chief Justice doubt our capacity as parliament in terms of our skills? Because in terms of the public, the Act, Section 10, it talks about accountability of the AG to the National Assembly. So where, and this parliament has got all competent skills resident here, but if it raises this, does justice think politicians don't have enough skills to play their oversight? I don't know, I need proper explanation, because if that is his understanding, I think it's misplaced. We have never, as an arm of government, as legislature, say that justice is incompetent. So it will be wrong if this is his conclusion, for one arm of government to pass a judgment like this, or making a statement like this. I need it to be properly interpreted. And the last issue, Chairperson, you remember we once discussed in our committee about the issue of clean audit as an opinion. Is this an international or universal agreed standard, or is a South African innovation which is not even provided for in any legislation? Is a wish that this is what should happen. But does that have any derivation from a legislation or a policy? And what, where does it come from and what does it mean? I hear it is used more often, but where does it derive its existence, Chairperson? Thanks.
Yeah, we have a second round. Can I have my advice as well? Just two comments, AG. Like colleagues, I think the matter of urgency is agreed upon. I don't think there's a question about urgency. And maybe following up on the last speaker around the fact that we might have to look at more than just the Public Order Act. You know, you gave us the example, AG, about the jetta and the truck, and you indicated that the finding would be irregular expenditure. Now, consequences for irregular expenditure are different to consequences of fruitless expenditure. Now, I could argue, AG, that the predetermined objective is to collect refuse, and that's why you agreed initially to buy a truck. You go and buy a jetta. Really, that should be fruitless and wasteful as opposed to irregular. I know you're going to put it as irregular, but if we look at it, wouldn't I have an argument to say it was fruitless because the intention was to collect refuse? You go and buy a jetta, and then you say, well, it's really not fruitless and wasteful, it's irregular. Because irregular is totally differently managed. So that is why I'm agreeing with Comrade Joe in saying that we might have to look at the PFMA. This thing of irregular, fruitless, and wasteful in itself has become a contested terrain. In itself has become, because people say, well, it's irregular, it's not really corruption. It's irregular, it's not really... So I'm saying we might have to look at the PFMA in that regard. But the second point that I wanted to make, again, I think this is what Honorable Singh was saying. You know, your recommendations, if I'm understanding them, AG, is saying we pick up a serial offender, we then, after having done what we need to do, take it to a law enforcement agency or to the public protector, whatever the case might be. Playing devil's advocate, I would almost guess that Parliament is going to be saying, but you are excluding us from our oversight. What are you reducing Parliament to? If the AG then takes it and takes it straight to the hawks without bringing it to Parliament, Parliament might feel that it's been left out. Now, what is happening in Scopa currently, AG? And I'm sure you're aware of it. You have your findings. Bring it to Scopa. Scopa sits there together with these law enforcement agencies that you're talking about. The anti-corruption task team, I think it is. And Scopa then is able to say, but Mr. DG, you aren't answering correctly. Here is the anti-corruption task team. Go and deal with it. And then Parliament must find a way of monitoring it. I'm saying that's a variation to what you are asking. In other words, Parliament also fits into the loop. Is that not an option? Because I'm saying this is what we're going to have to debate ourselves. Because I'm sure as MPs we can't work ourselves out of a job when it comes to oversight. So that was just a comment that I was making, AG, that maybe we might have to find a way. And then the final one that I would make is that, in fact, if we go this route, I would assume, honourable members, that... we're going to have some sort of public engagement with stakeholders. So it's not something that we can just ourselves decide and take to Parliament. We'd have to have public hearings or one of those type of things. So I just wanted to raise that. So the the urgency is there, but it's going to have to be a process, and therefore it becomes even more urgent for you to set up a meeting where we dress out how exactly we want to take this process. So, AG, those are the kinds of things that we're putting to you, but we agree in principle that we need to take the process forward. Maybe let me just check if there's another round of comments from any member, then you can respond to all of them together, and we'll take it from there. So it's Mr. Singh, I note, and Ms. Carter, do you want to say Ms. Carter? Just those two? So Mr. Singh and Ms. Carter, and then AG, you can make comments on everything we've said, and we take it from there. Honorable Singh?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, yeah, I didn't make comments earlier on the first part of the presentation. I confined myself to the second. But I see we are overlapping a bit, so let me just make a few comments which might help our strat planning exercise. And the one relates to the outsourcing of work by the Office of the AG. Now, the Act allows it. They do outsource. There are a number of state entities that are audited by private companies on contracts to the Office of the AG. Now, I think this is becoming a problem moving forward, because when looking at some of the state entities at Scopa or wherever, when we see the name of a company, whatever the name of the company is, as auditors, it's not the Auditor General, Office of the Auditor General. They're under contract, but not the office. So can the Office of the AG do some exercise on what would it take in terms of human and financial resources for the Office of the AG to be able to conduct all audits and compare that to the cost, the amount of money they're spending to engage private firms. Having due regard for the fact that, of course, there will be need to outsource for specialities. If you need an engineer, you spoke about an engineer early on, you spoke about housing, you'll need these special people who can provide assistance to the Office of the AG, but I'm talking about companies that we are using. So can an exercise be done in that regard, a cost-benefit exercise? Secondly, I had the point about the clean audit, also which Comrade Joe, Honorable Joe, brought about. And I think this came about when the former Minister of Local Government, late, Plessy So, from Eastern Cape, he started it, this term. But in anywhere you find, you know, qualified, unqualified, authorized, unauthorized, etc., disclaimer. But there's no clean. There's no clean. And the public out there wants to know what's clean, you know. It reminds me of, I was invited to a function once here by a municipality many years ago. We're celebrating the fact that they got a qualified audit. Say, we qualified. I said, what did you qualify? No, they qualified us. I said, hey, qualified means they found faults in your financial management system. Then the other aspect is the whistleblower aspect. Now, they do audits, you know, end of financial year, so many months, do your audits, etc. But there are whistleblowers. How are we going to make provision moving forward as the Office of the AG to cater for those? CETA was a classic example where when Terence November was the AG, there were AG's office were giving beautiful audits for that CETA. I can't remember which one. Ivor Blumenthal was in charge. But then some whistleblower came along and the next year they were condemned. Now, if it wasn't for those whistleblowers, the regular audits would not have picked up these kinds of things. So the whistleblower. And lastly, Chairperson is, and you experience this, the accessibility of management reports. Is there an unwritten convention anywhere that management reports cannot be made available publicly to a committee? Publicly through a committee. Because those management reports have the nub of the issues within a entity or a department. So what is the status of management reports? Thank you, Chair. And then Honorable Carter will talk about the judgment, I think, because she showed it to me, which brings in the Office of the Auditor General, which will be given some work according to this but I think she can speak to it.
I just wanted to give breaking news.
And well,
I don't know, maybe the Auditor General does know or they don't know, but they've been appointed by the court to evaluate and to oversee the process for a period of 12 months on the SASSA issue. Okay, now I've got a follow-up question, Chair, if you don't mind. And this is especially going back to the matter of the Jetta and the truck. And what I'm trying to get to there is, I think, you know, because we are working on samples, do we use the same type of sample all along? So say, for example, we're sampling 60% of the sample that we're going to do in the audit is going to be an amount of 200,000 Rand, for example, and 10% will be over an amount of 50,000 Rand. So I'm just trying to get those sample percentages, because if we are going to follow the same sort of cycle of doing samples, you're going to find that they would rather do small transactions if something needs to go wrong. It will go wrong where there is more amounts or more times using the smaller ones. Shouldn't there be a surprise level to it, that a sample is done on, it's not always the same? That's just a question.
Thanks. Hey, over to you.
Thank you very much for this engagement, Chair. I think we are hearing the members of the committee. The things that have been raised are definitely in our radar, a lot of them. I'm just going to deal with the specific questions. And just to say that we anticipated that as we are formulating this presentation, there will be a need for us to also formulate what we are putting out here into a proposed amendment bill document. We've already started with that work in the background. We just didn't want to give the committee that document because then it will redirect the discussion. We just wanted to put on the table the foundation for what we will come back with. Otherwise, we already have that as work in progress. We've initiated about 2 months ago, or just about, an engagement of this nature with the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor. And they are working very closely with us to advise us on issues about what options to consider, what sections may be relevant, as was articulated earlier on by Honorable Dubazana. Those issues in Section 20, what can or cannot be done, what is preferred so you can keep it clean without having to go the route of a long process of constitutional amendments and that. So we're going to take those on board, certainly, and then when we come back, as suggested in May, we will then have a clean document from which we will commence the discussion after it has taken into account a lot of the inputs and some of the issues that the members have raised. So that deals with the inputs that Honorable Dubazana has raised. I guess if one looks at some of these issues in terms of the mandate, let's say for performance audit for investigation, yes, the law does provide for that mandate. What we will be surfacing from an amendment point of view will be to respond to some of the recommendations that have already been made through the Kada Asmal report, where it said in that assessment there's not enough clarity as to that particular mandate for international work for performance audits. So it's about trying to propose an amendment to provide more clarity on it without changing it in terms of what it provides, but to make sure that it is adequate in terms of what it sets out for our mandate in that area. So that will be the context of those areas of the amendment. Now, coming to the matters, I'll come back to Honorable Carter. I know you spoke first, but let me deal with these ones just first. Honorable Singh, the move to performance audits. We are, and it's a difficult area to move into quickly. I think many of those countries have been on that journey for many years. In fact, what I can say is that we've intensified the level of engagement on this, not only from the type of audits that we do, but also from the type of people that we employ in performance audit. In the past, it used to be 80% odd were accountants. So for us to be able to do performance audits in areas of health, we employ people who are trained in that discipline. Because when we see a machine in a particular hospital as accountants, we probably are thinking about how much did it cost, where's the invoice as accountants. But a person who's medically trained, who's working with accountants, will understand firstly that that particular machine, for what it does in the first place, is not supposed to be where it is. That's the kind of stuff that we are starting to get in this performance audit. So that we don't see things for what they seem, but they're not really what they truly represent. And I think that's where the value comes in here, because an accountant can do so much in tracking the movement of the trail of finances, but will come stuck when they have to put an interpretation of an implementation of a road. How much does an accountant know how many bags of cement must be put into a 120-kilometer road if that's what the project is about? They're not going to know that. So in a performance audit, it's a systematic process of growing that discipline, because we ought to target the people who are well-trained in the areas that we've identified. For example, in education, we can follow the transactions as far as the expenditures are concerned, but whether the appropriateness of the interventions to improve the curriculum are concerned, we won't know that unless we have an expert who is an educationist expert who understands that discipline. And that's what we are growing in terms of those key elements of performance audit. And that's why we were able to release the type of reports that we did, because we've got those kind of people in our performance audit. And I think the reality of it as well is that it's not an easy audit to propose to somebody and get immediate acceptance for it to be done, because the person is worried that when you come into this audit, which is discretionary, it's unlike a statutory financial audit, which is a mandatory audit. Performance audit, even though it's provided in law, it's not a must do. You've got to persuade the person to come to the party for that. But I think it's a discussion that we will have with the committee as to how can we innovatively lift the game as far as the performance audit is concerned. Because those countries, many of them that are doing it, are appropriated specific parliamentary funding for them to do those. So they don't have to rely on the acceptance of the person on the other side of the table for this performance audit to be done. It's funded upfront. All you have to do is to decide that I'll do it. Unlike us, we have to negotiate whether you do have funding for us to do that particular performance audit, which catches us in a way in terms of making progress in growing it. But we're trying, and I'm sure we'll come to the committee to reflect on that journey. Chair, the other point I think which Honorable Singh raised regarding the responsibility for oversight, I think you're touching the real core of this. Because if you look at the overall accountability mechanism, it ought to stop with the people that have gone ahead and requested the funding to be made available to pay for and to do all other projects. It ought to stop with them. If there are these finances that go in the wrong direction, it ought to stop there. So ours is not to take over that responsibility. Ours is to say, we recognize the limitations of a statutory audit. In an environment where there have been 120 transactions, for argument's sake, in a particular project, an audit is likely, because of the sampling, coming to the point that Honorable Carter was raising, because of issues of sampling, because of issues of risk associated with certain transactions, because of issues of the limitations of the internal control environment and all of those things, and also the objective of an audit. Because an objective of an audit, I want to repeat, is to express an opinion on fair presentation of financial statements. And we can arrive at that conclusion if, out of all the transactions that are taking place within that area, we pick 10 of them and we test them. We can arrive at that conclusion on fair presentation. So when we pick the 10 transactions and we find 3 of them have not been carried out as expected in terms of the prescripts and all of that, we will report on those specific transactions. So what we are saying in terms of this mechanism, when we report on those, we are reporting on the occurrence of the deviation. the occurrence of a deviation. The fact that I have a budget of 100 million rands and I don't go through a supply chain management process. Currently, if we pick that deviation in the audit, we report on it. But at that point when we're reporting on it, nobody knows what were the circumstances or what are the real reasons for that particular deviation, because our mandate doesn't allow us to go beyond that. It says audit, which means we examine the audit evidence, and report, which means we surface the report. All you are saying in terms of this mechanism, you are not overreaching into an area that we should not be getting involved in. But what you are saying is you are trying to facilitate this issue so that this 100 million, when you look at it, and it has been looked at by an investigating agency, you can understand what were the reasons behind it. So that those that are supposed to act, who are still in the chain, they are not going to be taken aside, Chair, even including Parliament. When they have to come to the stage where they have to act, they don't have to make all sorts of assumptions about what was behind this particular irregular expenditure. Was there financial loss or was there no financial loss? By the time they have to exercise their executive or oversight responsibility, all you are saying is that let that information already be available. Because we as the audit do not extend our audit reports beyond that point. We will just articulate the issues around irregular expenditure, but if that irregular expenditure was complete waste of the money without the project being done, that's what that particular investigation will surface. And then that report will obviously be handed over to the people on the parliamentary or the executive side to be the ones who will ultimately take the action. So it's ready to deal with the gap that is always attached to an audit. Because ultimately, an audit gets misunderstood as an investigation that is supposedly responding to an allegation. So that is the clarity as far as the why this particular responsibility, why would it, is not going to get into that space where it's supposed to be dealt with in Parliament or the executive. All you are saying is this step that we are talking about is not normally covered in a statutory audit, but if you investigate that irregular expenditure with the hand of an appropriate institution, it will provide sufficient information for someone who is authorized to act to immediately have that information. And the example I'm using about this is the same one on the disclaimer. If we come to a conclusion that the particular entity is disclaimed, one of the reasons for the disclaimer is that we could not get all appropriate explanations, we could not get all the documentation. Currently, that situation, if left not investigated, tends to continue into the future. And so we are building a history over many years of transactions that have been entered into where nobody knows what the real reason was for the documentation not to be available. So what we are saying here is that to prevent that from becoming a recurring feature, when a disclaimer is arrived at, let it trigger an immediate investigation to get to the bottom of what is this documentation that is not being made available for independent inspection by the audit. Then that will provide transparency in the financial management system, because it enables those that are still charged with the power to act not to know the fact that there's a disclaimer without knowing why. And I think that is where we're coming from. We are trying to enable the system to know why there is a disclaimer, to know why there is a persistence of deviation from supply chain management disciplines, which increases the level of irregular expenditure, which by definition, I agree, is not always about corruption, if you like, but there's sufficient conditions to indicate that if left uninvestigated, a lot of these instances, they create a fertile environment for people who want to enter into transactions without documentation, for people who want to make payments without having received the service or the goods that they had intended to buy, to do it with impunity, effectively. So that's really where we're coming in. So we're not taking over the acting, we're just facilitating the clarity that is needed in order for those trusted with acting to be able to act in an appropriate way. Otherwise, through our audit reports, the identification of an instance of a deviation, but nobody knows the underlying reasons to the level of depth that is required in order to effect a consequence. on that particular issue. Let me clarify a couple of issues that Honorable Maswangani raised regarding the matter that we are referring to here about key ministers. Honorable Maswangani, when we refer to key ministers there, we are not classifying the members of the executive. All you are saying is that from our side as an audit office, we do not, for purposes of audit outcomes, we do not interact with every minister in all portfolios. There are three portfolios that are key to us. That key ministers means they are key to us as an audit office. Not that they are key ministers in relation to others. They are key to us, those being the Ministry of Finance, because it is the custodian of the financial purse. So whenever we deal with issues of audit, that ministry is key to us. When we deal with local government, the COCTA ministry is key to us because it is that ministry that facilitates issues of capacity, issues of responsiveness of local government. So if you look at another one, the Minister for Public Service and Administration, it is key to us because it is about the management of the human resource part of government, which also impacts on the internal control environment. Another one is the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation. It's a key ministry to us because it is a repository of the reporting mechanisms for performance information in government. So key is used in that context. Those ministries that are key to the work that we do primarily, but all of them are important, but those ones are key because whenever we have to enter into the roadshow space, for example, the Ministry of Finance, we meet them and they are the key for us to engage all our audit issues at cabinet. We don't have a minister because of our positioning in the system and the constitution. So there's no minister that sponsors an interaction for us if we need to share the audit outcomes with the cabinet. That ministry is the Ministry of Finance because it will have the key to allow an item on the agenda as part of that activity. So we'll be using the key in that context. Then the other one is the issue on page 15 that you referred to about the last bullet. What was referred to, if I may clarify it, Honorable Maswangani, there is that there are often a number of issues that come out in an audit that are technical in nature in many instances. Let's take an example. If we are having a big argument with Public Works through the property management trading entity, and there's a need to invoke a new generally recognized accounting practice insofar as the management of immovable assets is concerned. And those people are required to value those assets as prescribed in the auditing standards in a particular way so that they can reflect the true value of the assets in their books. There are a number of instruments and mechanisms that are largely in the hands of corporate finance professionals to be able to come to evaluation of those assets. And I think it is largely a matter that says, when it says here parliamentarians are differently skilled, it means that it will be difficult to have that technical conversation when you're trying to unpack that recommendation or finding generally in a parliamentary meeting, because you need to engage the technical experts who may be in National Treasury. Therefore, it says here that the role of parliamentarians is to maintain oversight, but we should not expect them to ensure implementation of all recommendations. Now, it means that in terms of implementing that recommendation to value immovable properties using all sorts of instruments and corporate finance tools will require the Auditor General to engage directly with those technical experts in that context. But recognizing the fact that ultimately, when it comes to the overall oversight, that still remains the role of Parliament. So it was largely trying to separate that technical aspect. And the issue of the clean audit and where it comes from. We certainly have not taken this from any standard. When we interpret our mandate and we look at the different categories of audit outcomes, we reduce our responsibility to the three areas that we are reporting on. One of them is the financial management discipline, which is the one where we conclude as to whether financial statements are qualified or not. Then the next one is whether we have reported accurately on the performance and the information that is presented in the report to articulate where performance has happened and whether there's evidence for it. So that part of it is the second component that we look at. And then the third component is the compliance with laws and regulations. Now, way back, Honorable Singh, even before the late Minister Chicheka invoked it, when there was that big conference meeting in Birchwood where all parties signed the pledge, it was at the beginning of the process that we were starting to increase our engagement in the public domain on audit outcomes, where the matter of how best to call this thing effectively was generated from South Africa. And I think that to generate it from here was largely in response to the very specific issues that we had highlighted as we were engaging in the public domain. One of them is we are going to constantly find it difficult, if you want to take this to the public domain, to explain those concepts like qualified, unqualified, and ad infinitum, because they are, in their own way, strange terms in the first instance. They are not pure English, a lot of them. Hence, when there was a celebration for qualifying, as if now you are needed, you belong here because you qualified. Whereas in the financial speak, that technical term, you're going to have to spend a month of Sundays trying to unpack it. So the preference was then to go for what we really have without even taking authority from it in the standards, to say if it is described as having passed those three areas, insofar as the context of the audit is concerned, it is regarded as free from significant defects, hence clean effectively. And therefore, it was largely to facilitate the understanding. And I think that understanding over the years has actually sunk in the public domain, which helps in many ways, because people, when they think clean, even though they incorrectly think the opposite of clean is corruption in most instances, but they know there's something that is not right about something that is not clean. It is largely to try and get people who are never introduced to this idea of engaging with matters of accountability in the public domain forever and a day to have a sense of what we're dealing with. Because these things, when accountants talk to each other in technical language, some people will never understand what they are trying to deal with. And I think, for want of a better word, clean is easily understood in the context of its opposite in most instances. And we believe that when we engage on the issues of clean and that concept, we always say, there are three components to it. Did you look after the finances as well as you are expected? Did you report on the things that you agreed to do as agreed? And did you use all the laws that are required to be used when you spend government money? The existence of those three components, in our view, are what assists the public system to narrow the space for possible abuse of public funds. And I think if people understand it in that context, we are in the game. So we'll take from the standards, Chair, let me say, what we believe is usable and appropriate. And I think we use our discretion sometimes to use these terms. As long as they are not misleading, they are not offensive, they are not driving a different message, they are driving a message that says, at any time when somebody speaks about clean and a disclaimer, we know these are the opposite ends of good and very bad financial management. And I think we've seen this and we've heard it when we see some responses in the media. The message has shifted many people's understanding. And that's why when we engaged with our last engagement on audits, the discussion was starting to look at, in light of all this, something needs to happen to correct what is being put on the table. Let me finish off, Chair. The matter of the referral, I think you mentioned the point here regarding the referral mechanism. Is it likely to exclude Parliament? I did respond to that part, linking it to what I thought would also happen as far as the executive is concerned. So ultimately, all of these, we will definitely prepare the detail to enhance the level of engagement on them. But the long and short of it is largely, as I said earlier on, our proposal in terms of strengthening these powers is largely about creating a mechanism where it is quicker to get to a situation where we restore the administrative and financial integrity of systems There are places where, in most of the audits that we do, where reconciliations never get done. And then you come into the department or into the entity, and you find that most transactions were being transferred into, say, one single account, a suspense account. So if I buy something, everything goes to that suspense account. We know, so they say, we know that the auditors are going to come at the end of the year, they're going to do an audit, and because the audit is a sample-based process, they will highlight certain of the things that we know we did not do right, and we'll just correct them, because once we correct them, then there's nothing that will happen. So it is about using this as a mechanism to strengthen the existing systems of internal control, so that if somebody posts something into a suspense account for the whole year with a view to paying for things that may not have been authorized through that account because there are no reconciliations, they ought to know that findings arising from that particular situation have got a limited time within which they will be investigated and appropriate steps taken to reverse them. So that is the angle from which we are coming, Chair. And when we approach the engagement for the next cycle, we will take it in that context. And thank you very much for the supportive words and also the engaging questions that you have asked us to go back on and come back with more comprehensive insights the next time we come.
Thanks, AG, and welcome to colleagues from the other portfolio committees. We always loved when you join us, especially if it's on a Friday. So, welcome. Just to the honourable members and AG, in a way of summarising our interaction today, I think the first thing that we're saying is that all of us in this room agree that we're going to move away from this term consequence management being a slogan to becoming a reality. It's really just a slogan now. It's going to move from slogan to become a reality. I think we all agreed on that one. We also all agree, AG and honorable members, that the process of legislative amendment is urgent. I think it's underlined, AG and honorable members, by the reality that next year, for all intents and purposes, is going to be very congested, because the year after that is elections. And we know that in the year before elections, Parliament receives lots of legislation from the executive. So for us, we have to get in before that avalanche of possible bills come to Parliament. So urgency, AG and honourable members, is key. So, I would imagine, honourable members, that sometime in May, Baba, we're going to have our own INDAP as members of Parliament, threat plan and all that type of thing, where we sharpen our own approach on some of these matters, including consulting colleagues from finance, appropriation, and anybody else that might be affected. So my proposal is that somewhere in the middle of May, we need to have our whole one-day stress plan workshop, at which point, AG, we've got the information that you have provided in a slide format, in a more user-friendly format for us, even if it means this proposed amendment or introduction or whatever you call it of your bill, even if you gave it just as rough as it is, so that it's something that we can put our teeth through and agree and disagree on. We will give you the date in May when we are going to get together, so if you guys could start working on something like that. And immediately we've done that, honourable members, we will then have to engage with you, AG, and have our fight about what we think is right and wrong or where we should go, and hopefully start the process of the legislative amendment, whether it's public hearings, whatever the case might be. So I'm suggesting that's how we do it, because I don't think we have any other urgent need for the AG next quarter, do we? There's no strat plan, there isn't any. So we'll use next quarter for legislative amendments. That will be the theme for next quarter plus our strat plan. So if the AG's team could start working on this document, taking into consideration what members have said, in terms of a bill that will be driven by Parliament, because it's a Parliament bill. And we start our strat plan session. And honourable members, we will give you the date, but understand that our day is only Friday. And you know that, honourable thing. We fought about that even yesterday. Unfortunately, some of these committees that we have only work on a Friday. So Dubazana and Carter and Joe and others will give you sufficient time, or sufficient notice, that on this particular Friday we're going to work the whole day. Because we just do not have any other time. We'll work the whole day, and when the AG comes, it doesn't have to be a whole day, it'll be a normal session. All right, if members are happy with that, that will then be our program roughly for the next 2 or 3 months. Looking at you, Cindy, and the rest of the team, you'll plan around that. Is that acceptable, honourable members?
Yes.
If that is acceptable, AG, once again, thank you very much. It doesn't mean that if there's something that crops up between now and when we call you after May, that all interaction stops. You're always free to talk to us. And whatever we get, we share with members, and we collectively decide how we're going to respond to you. But in the absence of that, we will probably be interacting with you through Cindy and the team for info, and our own face-to-face interaction will probably be towards the end of May, early June, where we'll do this. But you have our support that we are going to support and drive the amendments. As a team, all of us will drive these amendments because, as I said, consequence management is not just our problem. Cabinet talks about it, Scopa talks about it, everybody talks about it. We'll drive it and make sure that it's not a slogan, ma'am, that it becomes a reality, even for our friends in appropriation and in finance. So those words, thank you very much. Our meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Jess.